Thank you, Carrie. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being with us on this Lord's Day morning. We appreciate the encouragement of our brothers and sisters' presence, and we appreciate the privilege to remember the Lord together and remember what makes us a people who live in hope, and reminds us of our privilege and our task in this world through this new week. And we appreciate your service in the Lord's kingdom. We pray the best for your families and for you and your life through this new week. So if we tell you, if we can show you that there is an ethic for a civil society, that is something that we can do to live together in community, whether the community is a family or a congregation or a city or a country. If we tell you that, just as an observer of the world as it is right now, wouldn't you think that ethic is needed? Wouldn't you think that we badly need a way of living together in peace and in wholeness and in living in a worthwhile way? But if we tell you that that ethic is be holy, now just honestly for a minute, doesn't that tend to make your interest in the ethic for a civil society fade just a little bit? Honestly speaking, which one of us present here could do much better at defining what it means to be holy than our kids did a few minutes ago? That's a hard task to us. Doesn't the word holy in many of our experiences sound a little stuffy? Doesn't it seem a little bit irrelevant to where you're going to have to live this week and what you're going to have to do with? Just speaking honestly about it, do we really think that holiness is that much attached to regular everyday life? And then if we say, not only is there an ethic for living in a civil society that is to be holy, and that it comes from Leviticus 19, wouldn't you be somewhat surprised by that? I think what we need so badly right now isn't what we would expect to find in a rather odd Old Testament book. And just honestly speaking again, not very many of us would consider Leviticus our favorite book to read. I'm kind of with you at that. It's hard to read, and there are things about it that make it seem sort of odd to all of us. But folks, the fact is, Leviticus may be the most essential book in the Bible as a background for understanding the concept of Scripture. For example, what Paul just stood up here and led us in prayer about with regard to the Lord's Supper, there's no way to understand what the pain or the blood meant without the background of Leviticus. And when we talk about the concept of living a godly life or living in relationship to each other in a holy way, there's not a way to understand where we're coming from without the footing of this book. And the fact is that Leviticus 19, 19th chapter of Leviticus, have your Bible open there, by the way, if you would, is the background, the passage which expresses the ethic, the approach to life that the New Testament calls for in most of our favorite New Testament chapters. Leviticus 19 is behind what Jesus taught in Matthew chapter 5 when he asked God's children to be like the Father in heaven. It's behind Luke chapter 10 and the story Jesus told about the Good Samaritan. Who is your neighbor? It's behind Romans 12, which we read this week, which asks us, invites us to be motivated by the mercies of God and live honorably and kindly in community with each other every day. It's behind Ephesians chapter 4, which describes the behavior of the new man and involves everything from how we work to how we talk to how we forgive. It's behind Colossians chapter 3. Some people believe that Leviticus 19, the whole book of James, is simply an exposition of Leviticus 19. I know that there's a part of this chapter which is very specifically dealt with in James chapter 2 and again in James chapter 5 and in 1 Peter chapter 1. This is Peter's text about how God's children are to live in the world, and we'll get to that passage in a few moments. So this is a chapter that has a huge value even beyond the practical things it instructed the people of God to do back then. It has value as evidence, as Christian evidence, that I want to call your attention to this morning. And it has value for redemption. But most immediately, it has value for having some sense of how to treat each other and why in a healthy society. So let's approach it that way. This text is of value because of where it begins first. When we start talking about how we treat each other in our world right now, we have the tendency to want to begin with what we ourselves feel and think inside, or to want to begin with something which has happened in history, some injustice or something that wasn't right, and then react to it now, or to find some other immediate fear in our social construct of the day, and then to take sides and to be motivated by that. But not this chapter. This chapter says something very simple and profound. At the beginning of it, it is, I am the Lord your God. This is said at least 15 times through this chapter that I could count, who brought you out of Egypt. This chapter ends that way in verse 36. So this starts with who God is and with what He's done for His people. That's the beginning place. It's not anything that is about this race or that group or that nationality or that other one over here. It's not about that period of history, that decade or that century or this one. This starts with who God is. What is He like? What has He done? And more specifically, what has He done for us that we are responding to? That's the beginning place. And then it becomes more specific. Verse 2 of Leviticus 19. Speak to all the congregation of the people of Israel. That would be God's covenant people. And say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. The idea is, you shall be, for I am. Who God is and what He's like and what His character and nature is and how He is as a person, that's how you shall be. Because I'm your God and we are connected and we are related to each other. You're my family. I'm your father. You take on my character and nature. You shall be, for I am. Say that to yourself over and over in your mind this week. You shall be, for I am. And that leads to the definition of holiness that we operate from in our relation to each other in community, congregation, community, family, and everyday life this week. And here's the definition of holiness I want you to think about with me this morning. This imposing word, which holy, which can seem far off from where we are right now, comes home this way. To be holy is to be as God is in the world. To be holy is to go wherever you have to go this week and to do whatever you get to do this week, and in that setting, with whoever you meet this week, to be like God is and not like everything else around. This is an ethic or an approach to living which starts with the sense of wonder at the one who is other than ordinary. That's God. He's other than ordinary. He's the Holy One. And then this develops into an aspiration to be like He is in ordinary things. One of the remarkable things about Leviticus 19 is it starts with such a high idea and then gets right back to such basic everyday things. This is an approach to life which understands self in view of who the Holy One is and what He's done for us and how we're connected to Him, not in other ways. And this is an approach to life or an ethic which focuses on life as being rather than merely as existing or as reacting or getting or enduring something. Being. Who am I? What am I becoming? What do I want to be and to become? Now, in the unique thing about this part of this chapter is that it deals with human relations. And I'm just going to have time to read the passages to you, not necessarily to describe them, but we're going to put in front of you my ways of summarizing what these sections are. And I want to read the sections which repeat over and over again, I am the Lord, and we'll divide them up that way. We'll let them be divided that way. Here's being holy. Here's the value of this ethic in terms of what it envisions in human experience. First, revere mom and dad. To revere is a word which means simply to respect deeply. It doesn't mean to make gods out of them. But it says in verse 3, every one of you shall revere his mother and his father. This, of course, all the Ten Commandments come up in this text, by the way, and this is the fifth one, the hinge of life. But interestingly, it's reversed from the word order over in Exodus 20. Remember over there it says, honor your father and your mother. Here it's getting ready to tell us how to deal with the people around us, and it says, revere your mother and father. From mom, we learn so much about how to treat people. Mom and dad together become two people who have blessed our lives if they've done their jobs well, very much. And we revere them. It's the idea that I'm going to become, I'm going to be and to become something. First off, based on how I respond to the people who have invested themselves in me. And this turns into, interestingly, before this chapter is over, verse 32, you shall stand up before the gray head and honor the face of an old man, and you shall fear your God, I am the Lord. That's verse 32. So mom and dad get old eventually. And it'd be well for mom and dad to be teaching their children to how they want to be treated when they're older. The respect, the sense of respect begins with the relation to mom and dad. Revere your mom and dad. Secondly, keep God holy in yourself. And I tried to figure how in the world to summarize this. And I'm trying to illustrate these are not steps. This is a part of one whole person. But he said, "You shall keep my Sabbaths. I'm the Lord your God. Do not turn to idols or make for yourselves any gods of cast metal. I'm the Lord your God. When you offer a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord, you shall offer it so that it may be accepted." And it meant in their time, this is the one sacrifice that could be shared with others, but the rule was it couldn't be left over to the third day. And if you did that, then you profaned what is holy to the Lord. That all seems irrelevant to us until you realize what's being said. These three things is, you believe that real rest is found in God and not somewhere else. That's the Sabbaths that it's talking about. You believe that God is not like anyone else and you can't produce a better one than Him. That's why you don't make images. And you believe that what God said is to be respected, even in the ways where it would be easiest to get away with it, so to speak, which would be the peace offering that he's talking about here. Next, leave something for other people. Don't be so focused on yourself that you just hoard for yourself. Verse 9 says, "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge, neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest, and you shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord." There's something beyond simply interest in the poor and the resident alien here. There is a spirit which is generous, not covetous, which doesn't have to have everything in the world for self. It doesn't have to build barns bigger and bigger and get stuff more and more so that nobody else has a chance. I don't have to be the person who has to have it all for himself. That's what this is saying. Fourth, deal honestly with people and everything. Look how basic this is. Verse 11 and 12. "You shall not steal." Respect other people's property. "You shall not deal falsely." Respect the truth. "You shall not lie to one another. You shall not swear by my name falsely and so profane the name of the Lord," or to make the name of the Lord not holy. "I am the Lord." There is an honesty in those passages which is called for that we would like to tell ourselves is commonplace. But the point in this text, this is different from what people would do all on their own unless they had a good reason for it. In verses 35 and 36, this gets stretched out to weights and measurements, which would be used to cheat people in marketplace dealings. No, be fair and be honest and true. Deal faithfully with people, it says. Next, be considerate of persons. Value persons, whoever they are. Value a human being and treat them right. Look at the text here, verse 13. "You shall not oppress your neighbor or rob him." Don't take advantage of him. "The wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you all night until the morning." The reason for that is they worked a day at a time, and if they weren't paid, their family wouldn't eat. And you have the money that's going to be paying them, so don't just keep it overnight and make things hard for them. "You shall not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind." The deaf couldn't hear what you said. You could make fun of him or revile him, and he might not know it. Don't put something before a blind man that he can't see, and therefore you can trip him up, and it'll be great fun to you, but you will have dehumanized him. "But you shall fear your God." Notice how that "you shall fear your God" is the motive in all of this. "You shall be in the world as I am." Then next, pursue justice impartially. verses 15 and 16. You shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. But in righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. These would be people who would be called on to be the judges in the gate of the city from time to time. In righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. You shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor, that is, as a witness of some sort, a dishonest one. I am the Lord. The concern is justice in those verses. The willingness to hold all of us to a standard outside of ourselves and our personal preferences. It was God's insistence that there be one law for the resident and for the sojourner, and it be the same, and that the poor, neither the poor nor the rich, would be treated with partiality, but that the same standard of decency would apply. There are two mistakes that we can make with regard to social justice. One of them is for us just to not be interested in it. The other one is for us to let any political party or group define it for us. It is to be as God is in the world. Then the other thing is verse 17 and 18. You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. And you recognize in that last statement, the phrase that Jesus said was the second great commandment in the New Testament. But if you take the keep God holy in yourself, which is in Deuteronomy, loving God, and if you love your neighbor as yourself here, you are trying to regard your neighbor as God regards your neighbor and to treat your neighbor like you do because of what you think of God. And that's the highest standard for human relations ever given was introduced in Leviticus 19. That's a surprise, isn't it? Now, this chapter is bookended by statements that have to do with the person's use of his own body or others, and with statements that have to do with loyalty to the one God and not to idols or not to the pagan practices that surrounded them. But there is the definition of what it means to be holy in human relations. I'm going to leave that before you while we think about these two other things for a moment. If that's being holy, then wouldn't you agree that be holy is an ethic for a society which ours needs right now? If be holy in relationships is to treat people like that, to interact with people, but to be that kind of presence in the world, then wouldn't that enable us to live together, whether it's the community as a family or a congregation or a city or country? I think the answer is yes. And that, of course, is why I'm trying to read this with you this morning. But yes, only after we've come to grips with the value of this passage in two other ways, which I want to mention. One as evidence, and the other in redemption. Let's start with the evidence part. As an apologetic for godliness, for the faith of Christ, for example. An apologetic is an evidence or a defense. As a defense, this vision of humanity is extremely important, and our world doesn't like to think about it. What I mean is, if everybody lived this way, with everybody, all the time, would that be a place where you would want to live? Would that be a community where you'd want your children and grandchildren to grow up? It would for mine. But I remember the philosopher, German philosopher Immanuel Kant, in 1785, proposed what he called the categorical imperative for making moral choices. This is not as complicated as you may think. Here's what he said. Act only according to that maxim whereby you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. Could you do those things willing or wanting for that to be the way everybody acted? Yes, you could. You could build community that way. If everyone would do that. So I have to ask us, where did this high ethic come from? How do you account for the expression of such a noble aspiration in human relationships in the middle of a pagan world of somewhere around 1300 BC? And how do you account for its presence in the Roman world of the first century AD when you read Romans 12? And how do you account for its worthiness right now in the 21st century Western world? Where did it come from? We believe from the God who calls us to Him. Another way to say this same thing. Without Him, where will we find the power to encourage or to produce this kind of behavior in the world? Will we be able in our schools or in Washington, D.C., will we be able to enact a law that will produce this kind of interaction with each other? Will we be able to establish ordinances or enforce upon people by social pressure that we live this way? We can create a lot of anger and a whole lot of resentment and a whole lot of miserable human failure, but we're not going to get there without a God who is like that. That brings us to the other way this be holy help. It calls not only for explanation, but also for redemption, because this may be desirable, but the question is whether it, for creatures like us, whether it's doable. Who has ever been this way, completely inside out, toward people who were friends and enemies and toward God for a whole life? I think there's only one answer to that question: Jesus Christ. But on the basis of His life and in Him, the God who brought out of Egypt a people to be holy as He is has brought now a people out of ignorance and futility through whom His holiness can be shown forth into the world. That's the drama of the gospel. That's the point. On the basis of what Christ has done, God has redeemed a people to be His, to show forth His glory in the world by godly living. I want to read to you from 1 Peter 1, thinking that you'll recognize Leviticus 19 here. In 1 Peter 1, beginning at verse 14, as obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance, but as He who called you is holy, you also shall be holy in all your conduct. What does that mean? Remember what holiness is? To be as God is in the world. Since it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Where was that written? Leviticus 19:2, among other places. And if you call on him as Father, who judges impartially according to each one's deeds, conduct yourself with fear throughout the time of your exile, knowing that you were, and here's the thing, I look at this and I can see the places where I've fallen short of that and failed that high calling. But thankfully in Christ, knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. He was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but was made manifest in these last times for the sake of you who through him are believers in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. Ransomed from sin by the blood of Christ, and hoping in God by the resurrection of Christ. We are free this week to go out and try to be in our community a presence of God's character in the world around us. And if we do, we will contribute to a civil society in a more powerful way than we're even in a position to imagine. And that's what we are praying for each other for this week. How about you? Have you allowed God to bring you out of the futile ways that we've gotten from the world? Do you call on him as Father? You can if you let him, if you let the ransom of Christ be yours. If I'd read on in 1 Peter 1, we would have read of being born again by being obedient to the gospel of Jesus, and then of becoming children in a family, babies in a family, so that we try to grow together. If you haven't made that beginning and would like to, and if we can help you in doing so, we always offer in our meetings on the Lord's Day an opportunity for people to let us know. This isn't the only time you could take a step like that, but if you want to today, we're here to help you. If you'll let us know by coming here to the front while we stand and sing.